Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Nicole Washington. Nicole is a renowned serial entrepreneur, innovator, executive, and management consultant. Nicole, thank you for sharing your considerable expertise and insights and wisdom with our audience.
Stephen, thank you very much for inviting me. I count it a privilege to be among your growing list of very interesting interviewees.
Now, Nicole, you have this... it's an amazing background. You've had this fascinating STEM journey yourself. Now, can you share some of your compelling stories from an early age up to graduation from college and why you made each of the choices in your path?
Oh, wow. That's quite a long and I think probably interesting story, unlike maybe some of your other interviewees. I think I would say it all started with $5 watches. When I was a young kid in elementary school, we used to have in the U.S. $5 watches, very thin watches, and $5 was a pretty inexpensive price even back then. And I had so many of these watches because they would break. So they would break, and I would collect them, and I would take a part from one piece and put into another and just kind of figure out how to make it work again. And so from that early age and with all of the career assessment tools that the schools would use to help you figure out what you wanted to become, I knew I wanted to be a mechanical engineer. But the journey to get there, I had no idea how that would happen. My parents, I grew up in a two-household parent family. And then when I was about 10, I found myself in a single-parent household. And so at that time, of course, when that happens, usually there's not a lot of money to go around, and that's where we found ourselves. So I knew by the age of probably 16, 17, that I wasn't going to have enough money to go to college. An interesting thing happened to me. I grew up in a small town, and I was recognized as one of the kids who would get an awesome opportunity to go to a state-supported boarding school. And what they wanted to do is get all of the kids that had great aptitude in the areas of science and math and have them go to this special school. And I was chosen, and I decided to go. So I left my friends from my high school. I went to a new school where everybody was so smart. I didn't know if I was quite as smart anymore. But when I went there and I started applying for colleges, I knew I had to have some money in. And I knew I wanted to be this engineer, but how would I get there? So I applied for so many fellowships and scholarships, and I ended up getting a fellowship for teaching. So I said, well, this isn't quite engineering, but what is the closest thing to engineering that a teacher could do? And, of course, that was to teach math. And that's what I did. I ended up going to school for undergraduate work to be a math teacher. And so along this journey, I graduated, and I started teaching math, and I actually really loved what I did. I loved sharing knowledge and teaching it to a new generation of children, but I still had this underlying passion to become an engineer. So I began to apply for graduate schools, and I met a gentleman at the time who would soon become my husband, and he was applying for jobs, and we found our package in the state of Ohio. And that was, for me, the Ohio State University. I became a Buckeye, and I went back to school for engineering. And at that time, interestingly enough, the Internet wasn't quite as big as it is now. It was just kind of becoming known. And I ended up doing a computer-aided instruction tutorial for my thesis work. So my professor was so keen in combining the skill sets that I had for the aptitude in math and engineering and also my teaching skills, and I was teaching an undergraduate class by way of using this tutorial that I created. So that's kind of how my passion for systems and technology started to develop during that time. Long story short, I began to notice the Internet, and I already had this background in developing systems. It was very in vogue, and here's where the compassion and the will to want to be an engineer takes a little turn. When I graduated with my master's degree in industrial engineering, it was very in vogue to go work for big six accounting firms who had the side called management consulting. So I never quite made it to become a real engineer. And I went to work for these firms, and they also had a lot of systems work, which was very intriguing to me. So I ended up working on the mainframe computer And remember this underlying passion and desire to learn more about the internet, because that's going to come back into play here. But I did a lot of mainframe work, didn't do anything with the C++ and all those interesting computer programming languages that I learned in graduate school. But I did get to learn about corporate systems and how they worked and how to restructure them, and those things were very intriguing to me. And after a while, with this Big Six Management Consulting, we did start doing a lot of traveling. I didn't want to do that anymore, so I started working for some smaller firms. And then I decided I wanted to be an entrepreneur. So I took my love for systems work and solving problems, and I saw this passion of the internet and what I thought I knew about business, and I took a turn to become a business entrepreneur and started my company, MicroBiz Coach. So does that give you a kind of a feel for how I got from a watch tinkerer to a business consultant?
You know, that's just such an interesting story, and that journey is inspiring. I mean, I'm excited hearing it, and I'm sure you had some sort of roadblocks along the way. Can you describe maybe one or two of them?
Well, yes. I can tell you from the time that I wanted to become an engineer, there were a couple of roadblocks. I told you about one. One was I just didn't know how I was going to pay for my education, so I thought that I would never get to fulfill that dream, and then I got the teaching fellowship, which was great. I loved the fact that I had the opportunity to have my education paid for. The other was when I actually decided that I wanted to go back to school for engineering, I got an opportunity to. My background, I don't know if you know much about engineering, but they are a very interesting group of people. Engineering requires a very keen sense of problem solving, and you get prepared in so many ways to go out into the world and solve big problems. And part of that preparation is very technical, and you have to understand a lot about how things are built, created. You have to understand sometimes systems, depending on what type of engineering. You have to understand logistics. You have to, in order to get those understandings of how things work together, they want you to learn a lot about math, and the math gets very detailed and complex. And the people who were on the selection committee for graduate school in engineering at Ohio State at the time had some doubts about whether or not I could handle it, because I had come up through a quite different system in my undergraduate career. So that was another roadblock, just kind of convincing them. But I did have some high scores that helped to convince them. And I was on a limited fellowship my first year, and my grades were excellent, and it just kind of proved that I could really handle the rigor of an engineering program. So that was that could have been a very important roadblock for me that would have prevented me from kind of taking the path that led me to where I am today. So I had to use a lot of persistence and some other elements of endurance to get through those times.
I mean, those are some really good lessons in that you didn't give up and you didn't let any sort of roadblock sort of stop you. You persisted and you had confidence in yourself, and you said, you know what, I'm going to keep moving ahead, and there aren't roadblocks, they're just opportunities, and you looked at those opportunities and you were able to leverage all of them. Now, Nicole, you talked about the fact that you went into management consulting. So again, because you've had this great, you know, sort of ability to gain all of this experience, are there some lessons that you can share from your work in management consulting?
Definitely. One of the biggest lessons, I think, with management consulting is you have to be prepared for change, because you're on one project for a certain amount of time to do a certain job, and then you switch to another. So I think you have to really embrace change. And you also have to be a good problem solver, and you have to be kind of quick problem solver, because you come into an organization and you have to get to know a lot of things about that organization in order to help solve their big problems. They bring you in to solve the big problems. So you have to know how to process that information fairly quickly and efficiently so that you can get to the problems in a decent amount of time. One of the other things that I think is very, very important about being a consultant, particularly management consultant, is having really compassion for the people who are there, the people who have been there for years and who really know more than you do about their subject matter and about the inner workings of what they do from day to day. And a lot of times, management consultants can get a little pompous. I don't know where that comes from, but they can, you know, just miss the fact that all of the knowledge, a lot of the knowledge that they need is in the people who work for those companies. And just having a little bit of compassion for those people and how they might feel for someone coming in from what they would call the outside to try to help them solve those problems is very important, because you have to create good relationships. That's another thing that I would advise as a tip. You have to really create good relationships. Number one, if those people have the information you need, they won't give it to you if they don't like you. You know, or unless, if they do give it to you, they're forced to give it to you, and it takes a long time. So that kind of interferes with your efficiency that you need when you go in there to help solve those big problems. So it's a lot about people dynamics, relationship dynamics. And then you just have to have a passion for, I think, learning, because you have to go in there and you have to learn things that you didn't necessarily know. And that's one thing that I think you want to spot in a good potential consultant, is they have the ability to learn and the passion and desire to do that. It's so important in that field.
Nicole, I mean, those are really some great tips that you passed on from all the years of experience working at such a high level. I also had this opportunity to see something called the Academy when I was in Orange County, and I was just surprised at the amount of work being done and sort of the leadership that you're taking. Can you talk about this work at the Academy and your role in it?
Sure. The Academy is a STEM high school, and for the listeners who may not be as familiar with STEM, it stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics, traditionally. But nowadays, people are calling it STEAM, and STEAM with two M's, and that's Science, Technology, Engineering, Arts, Math, and then Medicine. So a lot of fields are combining to make what we call a STEM school. And the fields are important because those are the fields of the future, where we need more people to be very, very savvy in those areas. The underlying, I think, discipline in all of that is technology. And so what we're doing at the Academy is we're creating a generation of students, future workers, future CEOs that have an underlying understanding of technology and its impact on our society now, and even the future impact on our society. And we are doing, it's a tremendous work, because we're not just taking what people would call the best and the brightest traditionally, but we're taking kids that are traditionally what I would call underserved. So there's a certain part of our society, particularly here in the U.S., where people are underserved. They don't get as much attention as people in other parts of our communities. For example, Orange County, where the school resides, is one of the wealthiest counties in the U.S. And within that county sits the seat of its government, and one of the poorest cities in the U.S., and that city is Santa Ana, and that is where the school resides. And so we get kids from that community. It's a charter school, so the kids are basically in a lottery. They have to choose to go there. And what we're doing, from my perspective and the work that I do so intimately on the Career Advisory Council, that's the council that I lead there, is we're trying to give the children an opportunity that they may not otherwise receive. And these are opportunities like children from, let's say, wealthier communities would get every day, many of them. And that is to, you know, come home and basically see a mom or a dad or a guardian that works in a high-skill job, or that has friends that are, you know, doctors, lawyers, engineers. A lot of times children in underserved communities don't get to experience those things, where they can be around dialogue that talks about these careers, that gives them insight into those types of careers, that gives them a vision of what they could become, of what opportunities are available. Many times the underserved children don't feel like those opportunities are available to them. So one of the things of my council is to make sure the curriculum is equipped with things that allow them to see themselves in these places where we need them. We really need them to be available and to be skilled to contribute to the society when they're at that age, and even some at an earlier age. So we bring in career exploration opportunities during the ninth grade year, where they go out and visit companies. We're so fortunate to have so many good companies that partner with us in our communities, engineering companies, high-tech medical device companies, even attorneys, city government, and they get to experience this by way of just kind of an introduction to the technologies and jobs that are there. And then during their sophomore year, we have a mentorship program where we pair them up probably in a ratio of a 1-2 or 1-3 with an industry mentor of the career that they begun to find themselves interested in. And we have basically it's a mentor small group instead of a one-on-one mentorship relationship. And we allow them to take a more intimate look into these careers by asking questions of the mentors, participating in panel sessions with the mentors. And then during their junior year, we are going to have internship opportunities that are, again, coming from the great companies in our community and the city government. And they, all along, the students are keeping portfolios of their experiences, of their project-based learning that they do at the school. It's very, very high on project-based learning within their curriculum. It's a project-based learning curriculum, which means they're very interactive in their education. And then finally, during their senior year, they are going to have a culminating senior project, much like children or basically students and young adults do in their college and university careers. So that's kind of an overview of how we prepare them to then be productive citizens, employed or entrepreneurs when they graduate from high school and college.
Now, you have various, like you said, you chair this committee and there's a board and so on. Is that information public about who are supporting this program?
Yes, that is information is public. Actually, the Academy is a project of the Orangewood Children's Foundation, and that foundation has been around to support the foster youth community, and it's been around for a long time in Orange County, and it's very productive in what they do for the foster youth community. The school itself has plans to become a residential school for some of our foster children. And the reason is because if you know much about the foster lifestyle, foster children will experience 10, 12 sometimes schools before they graduate. And it's not a very stable, if you can imagine, educational experience going from school to school, sometimes mid-year. And, you know, foster children are very important to our society. As we get more and more of them, we really want to provide an opportunity for them to succeed and without having a label of foster children. So the school will allow them to go to a normal school. And if they need the residential component, they can live on campus during the week and potentially go home to their family or relatives who sometimes just can't take care of them all the time, but maybe on the weekends they can. So we have all sorts of plans for the school. I should mention that the school, the inaugural year of our school, the Academy, was last year where we had our first group of freshmen. And then this year we have a group of sophomore and freshmen, and then every year we will add a new grade. And hopefully within the next couple years we'll have that residential component there. So we're still building the school right now, but we're doing a great job in modulars. You wouldn't believe the comments of the children. They love the school. They feel like it's a family to them. We have a very high percentage of high achievers on the honor roll, which is unlike our counterparts across the United States that have a geographic or a school of our geographic makeup. And also one of the very interesting things about the school is that we have a tremendously high, over 95% attendance rate. And if you know anything about attendance in high school, particularly of our underserved community across the United States, it's nowhere near 95%. So I'm really proud, actually, of the school and the great job that the board, which I am a part of, but we just have some tremendous people, and the headmaster of our school just does a tremendous job creating this culture that the students are able to thrive in.
Nicole, you also have a career as a member of the Ohio Tech Angel Fund, which is the second largest angel investor network in the U.S., and you've got a lot of experience investing and looking at high-growth companies and so on. You know, let's mine some of that deep insight you have. Can you describe some of the areas that you look at when you're investing?
Yeah, so when I'm investing as an individual, I usually look at things that I'm passionate about or something that I know quite a bit about. But when you're in a group like the Ohio Tech Angel Fund, the second largest angel investor network in the United States in terms of numbers, and sometimes we're number one depending on what the Tech Coast Angels are doing. But when you're in a diverse group like that, you're generally looking for us, some very specific things. But for the Ohio Tech Angel Fund, we're looking for technology companies in particular that bring values in terms of jobs or economic growth to the state of Ohio. And so when we're looking at these companies, one of the things that I like to evaluate them on is their business model in particular. You know, do you have a way of making money? And then how is that way sustainable? Is it scalable? Something that basically, you know, when you're an investor, you invest a certain amount of money, and you're not necessarily just giving it, you're investing it, which means you expect a return. And so the things that you look at in a company are the things that would help you evaluate whether or not you're likely to get a return on your investment. So the business model is a very important component of whether or not the return is going to be possible. You want to look at the management team, I think, and whether or not they're a cohesive team and how do they work together. And it's easy to look at people working together when things are great, you know, when you have a lot of money, when technology is working just as you had pictured it. But what about when the market that you've chosen or your target market goes south, becomes, you know, the target market of somebody else, or they don't like your technology anymore, your technology that you thought was great is not the greatest technology because the market has changed in some way. How is the management team getting along then? How do they work through that problem? Are they able to work through it? And do they come up with another solution? Because those things do happen. I mean, we're investors and we're entrepreneurs, but we're not, you know, fortune tellers. We don't know what is going to happen, even though some of us can predict it very well. Sometimes those predictions don't pan out. And so we have to know how to kind of move with the ebbs and flows of entrepreneurship and business and changes in the technology cycle in the business world. We like to look at whether or not the company has a handle on the competition. What is the competition for your product or for your technology? Do you have a handle on what that is? Do you have any IP, for example, that would help you sustain your leading edge above your competition? You know, what is it that distinguishes you from the competition so that the competition can't just come in, start doing what you're doing, and because they've maybe been out there longer, then they get an edge on the market, and then you have one of those problems you have to solve, you know, with what do we do now that we've lost our edge in the market or that we can no longer sustain ourselves with our current business model. So those are just some of the things that we look at. Usually when I'm doing due diligence, when I'm looking at all these things and on the team to evaluate whether or not we should invest in a company, my role is the technology role. I love to investigate the technology to see if it's, you know, a good technology, if it's sound, if it's based on sound technology principles, and things like that.
Now, there's some research that indicates that angels typically invest in 1 out of 40 projects or proposals, and VCs, venture capital people, will invest maybe 1 out of every 400, maybe tier one venture capital in Silicon Valley. And then let's say out of 1 out of every 400, and let's say out of 1,200 in total, they'll invest in 3. They'll make money on 1, they'll break even, and they'll lose money on the 3rd. Are your experiences similar to that? Do you find your numbers sort of are aligned with that, or do you find they're different?
Well, I think, you know, depending on the investment group and, you know, and it doesn't, even if you do some of the groups do a lot of due diligence because we're very careful in who we invest in, and we don't, you know, we want to kind of save our bullets, we call it. And some groups, they just want to get a lot of companies through the pipeline and they invest a lot. So depending on your strategy, I think those numbers will change for us in particular. Sometimes, I mean, I feel like we're salesmen because we have the, you know, one out of every 10, you know, some years, and kind of changes with the market. But it's very, very true that you are a true angel when you do angel investing. And I guess the VCs may feel like they're angels sometimes too. But angels in a sense that we know right off the bat that many of those companies are not going to yield us a return on our investment that really, you know, warrants all the time that we put into it. But out of probably the 10 companies that we invest in, if we can get one to hit really big, it makes it all worth it for us in terms of investment and then the hard work that you put into it. But you have to remember, if you choose a really good angel investing organization or VC organization, you're going to get so much more than money from the perspective of the entrepreneur. And if you join a really good angel investing or investment vehicle and organization, you're going to give so much more than money. It's the insight into business that you're able to offer. And it's also the insight that the entrepreneur can get. And so it's almost like a teacher. And here I go pulling from another skill set, but you're able to pour into the kind of the next generation of investors. If you notice, a lot of entrepreneurs that really become successful, they turn into investors. But you're pouring into the next generation of entrepreneurs, because also, if you notice, successful entrepreneurs often are not successful on their first round. So same thing with investors. So it really is about so much more, and that's what keeps us coming back to the table after, you know, investing in 10 and reaping rewards from one many times.
Do you have any sort of recommended tools or resources that startups can look at based on your experience?
Tools and resources. One of the things that I think is good for startups is probably to understand right now the technology landscape and all that is available to them. What I would say probably free of charge as they start up. And we have some of those things on what we call a micro biz kit that we offer to startups. And it's basically a database full of online resources where you can find things in terms of accounting resources that you can use online. And a lot of these, we try to find the free or very inexpensive tools, because when you're a startup, you really don't have a lot of cash flow to spend freely as you do maybe later on, and I would argue that maybe not so freely then if you're conservative with your cash flow. But so we have a lot of tools in terms of accounting tools that you can use, mind mapping type tools that you can use when you're creating strategy for your company, which is very important to do. There are tools in the way of website building, which of course every startup, you know, every company needs a website these days. But just because you're a startup in technology doesn't mean you know how to be a webmaster. So there are webmaster or web developing tools that will allow you to create a website with very little knowledge. So these are just kind of general components that startups would need as they get started. Also, the Angel Capital Association is a good place to go when you're looking for funding. When you're a startup, generally most startups would start at the angel level. And one very important thing that you need is a way to fund your startup after you go through your friends and family, and you know your savings that you have, you usually deplete that sometimes, but you're going to need a way to fund that. And so we have those types of resources at the Angel Capital Association website.
You know, you mentioned this vehicle or platform called the Micro Biz Coach. Can you talk more about that? And I know that you own it. So what prompted you to start it?
Oh, that's a very interesting question, and one that goes way back again, Stephen. I grew up, like I said, with both parents at one time. And then when I found myself in a single parent household, I was still very close to my father. My parents divorced. And my father, when I was young, started his own business. And so that was kind of really my introduction into the world of business. And so I was able to learn so much from his journey during that time. And one thing I noticed is he had an incredible product. and people loved it. I mean, from miles around, it was very good. And he was a very savvy guy. You know, I thought a lot of them, he really knew how to create relationships and talk to people and make connections. But one of the things that I realized was a good product and sometimes making connections in the way that he could make them, they just aren't enough to sustain you as a good business. Particularly in my time of internet technology and growing technology, you have all your big companies who you're basically competing with sometimes, particularly in the technology space. So that kind of gave me a heart for what I would call the little guy. And that's hence the name of my company, Micro Biz Coach. And we started with a very keen focus on helping smaller micro businesses develop through the use of internet technology. Because what I found when I had that interest in the internet, as I talked about earlier, was that internet technology could make a small company look big, and it could also help a small company achieve so many things that they couldn't do on their own. Internet technology is like one of your really good partners, you know. And so I had, you know, the business sense and what I thought was good enough acumen from my experience out in management consulting and working with all these big Fortune 100 companies, getting to know the CEOs, the management teams. And I thought that I could take that and my love for technology from when I, you know, did my thesis during my master's degree, and my just sense of curiosity about what the internet could do. I thought I could package all of those things and help the little guy develop something that they could be proud of and that they could take to other people and show that they had some credibility. And so that's how we started. But what I found out very quickly, and I was very involved in all the business organizations and women's business leadership teams of the state of Ohio at the time, which is where my company started. And for many years, what I did was I helped small companies, and I found out one very important thing. There's not a lot of money in doing that. And so you don't do it for the money. But more importantly, you have to find a way to sustain your company when you're helping those types of businesses. And so the way I supplemented, I was very fortunate. I was able to supplement through high-level consulting that I could do on my own. But my team, I'm so intrigued by what business ownership means in the U.S. in terms of economic opportunity, that I started my entire company by seeking good partners who would be willing to form their own small businesses in order to partner with me. So instead of doing it traditionally through hiring people as employees, I basically coached people and taught them how to own a business and use their skill set to help me with my business. So the kind of very interesting way things came together, but I was able to find some great talent, particularly in stay-at-home moms who, for example, one of my greatest partners had a master's in computer science. But back then it was somewhat of a trend for women to start staying at home when they had their kids. And these women were so smart and had so much ability. So I just found another way to use their talents. And MicroBiz Coach was born from that. And I've really had a very interesting ride with the company and with just getting to know the landscape of small business and how it works and how it can be successful.
You know, you're a notable authority in business and in technology and entrepreneurship and angel funding and so on. And you have this amazing business, this Micro Biz Coach business, and you've been able to gain a considerable amount of experience helping so many businesses out there. So can you share some of the tips of driving success for businesses?
Yes. Thank you for asking that interesting question. One of the most important things, I think, in the way of driving success for business is persistence. I mentioned earlier there's so many ebbs and flows in the world of business that the quality of persistence is very, very important to staying the course, and not just staying the course, but figuring out how to navigate through the issues that are going to arise. And so there's persistence in problem solving. You know, when you have a problem, which you're going to have, you have to, I think it's just important to embrace the fact that, okay, there's a problem, there's an issue here, what are we going to do about it? You know, and let's get down to the business of figuring things out so that you can continue forging ahead. And in order to do that, in my mind, it's very important that you assemble yourself with a good team of people. And even if that team of people are not directly related to your company, for example, you know, they may not be your, you may not have a CEO, a chief operations officer, or a information officer and those things, a CFO. You may not be big enough to have those things, but you can have a board. You're big enough to have a board of advisors. And even if it's an informal board, you should have people who are around you who are very, very savvy and those important areas so that you can have help getting through some of the issues that you're going to face. You know, it's the smartest people need other people around them. For one, you know, when you're having a problem, sometimes you tend to focus on your expertise with the problem. And oftentimes problems are big enough so that if you don't have more than one area of expertise at the table, it may take you a lot longer to solve, even though you may get there. It may take you longer to get there, and in many cases, you won't get there, or the solution won't be as robust as it will if you have that good team of people. But also, I think in business, it's very, very important, excuse me, in our day and time, to embrace technology. Technology is so key to almost everything we do in the business world. Even if it's a business that is very much a humanitarian component, the systems that you use behind the scenes often require some understanding of technology. But I think that's good. Even if you have other people doing the work, if you have a baseline understanding of technology, it's easier for you to understand when things don't go right on the technology end, why, or it's easier for you to help push towards a solution when technology is a factor in the problem that you're trying to solve. Also, I think it's very, very important to have a stream of income or revenue when you're in business. So you have to kind of have some foresight into how you get that stream of revenue and make sure it's sustainable. So, you know, knowing these things about angel investing or, you know, VCs and when you go from one stage to the other, very important. And it's something I didn't know early on. And when I found out about it, you know, I found out that you can go get money from places and you don't have to mortgage your house to do it. Oh my gosh, I was so excited. I said, I'm going to tell everyone that I know about this. So just having an understanding of those things, I think, is very, very important in the world of business. Even if you're a successful business and you're a small business, sometimes you want to move to the next level. And so just understanding those avenues are good. And finally, I would say, Stephen, that having a good mentor, even if it's an informal mentor, you don't necessarily have to go up to someone and say, hey, will you be my mentor? I mean, some of my greatest mentors, particularly in investing, are the guy that started our fund, and just to get the knowledge, the wisdom, the experience without having to go through all of that yourself, it's invaluable. So those are the things that I think are great components when you're in the world of business, whether it's a micro business, a small business, or a developing big business.
Nicole, you're this international expert, and you've had just a tremendous amount of success, and I know you're a serial entrepreneur as well. And you have this thing called Nicole's Naturals. Can you talk to me more about this?
Oh, yes, yes. Thank you for asking. Nicole's Naturals. That's so interesting, the transition that I made into the food and beverage industry. Little known fact, as I am investing in things, I found out that the food and beverage companies have a higher return on your investment dollars and a higher exits, and exits meaning when you sell your company you get more money than technology companies right now. And so I was so intrigued by that that was part of the reason why I decided to forge ahead with Nicole's Naturals. Nicole's Naturals basically is a company that focuses on gluten-free products that do not taste gluten-free. If you know anything about the world of gluten-free products, Traditionally, they have been very lacking in flavor, very lacking in texture, and a few other things, so that people who do not have to eat gluten-free really stay away from them. But that poses a very big problem, because traditionally there's one person that is responsible for the meals in the house, and if that person has to have a has to provide for someone who's newly diagnosed as gluten-free, which is becoming a new diagnosis here in the U.S., and they have to prepare for everyone else, then they have a dilemma of preparing two meals, and that's not so fun if you're used to being the cook in the family. So what we do at Nicole's Naturals, right now we have one signature product, and it is a waffle and pancake mix that is gluten-free, but it doesn't taste gluten-free. And we've had people from some of your major retailers to try us out, and they noticed that it doesn't taste gluten-free. So we have a really good product, and that's the start of a good company. But as you know, it's not the entirety. But with this company, I basically started it because of my knowledge of food and beverage, or my growing knowledge of food and beverage companies, but also because of my diagnosis with gluten intolerance so many years ago, at least a decade ago, back before it was even popular. The good thing about our company is that we're coming around during a time where being gluten-free is very, very popular. And it's not only for people who need it medically, but it's becoming a trend in the diet industry. And if you know anything about diet industry, those things often turn to gold if you can find a good product there. So we're just hoping to become noticed maybe by some of the, big companies, Kellogg's and such, that have products now that are not gluten-free, that they'd like to enter into the gluten-free line but keep their same taste and quality of product. And we'll see what happens. It's very fun.
It just sounds so exciting. And you must love getting up every morning.
I certainly do. I certainly do. It's, I think it's left over from my years of management consulting, where I would do different projects, every few months. Now it's like you get to, as an entrepreneur, it's so fascinating, but you get to create your palette, I guess you will. If you're an artist, you would just take kind of a palette and make of it what you will. And it's kind of interesting, but the world of entrepreneurship allows you to do that. If you have the right people, network, and team around you so that it's sustainable. But it's fun being able to do that and being able to meet so many interesting people along the way. I mean, who knew I would meet so many people who we call foodies now, from it with a technology background. But it's true. I am meeting them, and it's quite fun. It's a different use of your brain, I think, in some ways.
Now, you have these two programs, the Micro Biz Coach, and you have Nicole's Naturals. Do you have some plans from a global expansion standpoint, and then how you will execute it?
I think particularly for Nicole's Naturals, there's one thing I noticed. I did some travel in China this past summer. I've been there before a few years ago, but as you know, China changes so fast and so often. And one of the things that I noticed there is that they're very, very interested in food imports for them. It would be exports for us, but they're very interested in getting foods imported from countries such as the United States and other countries. And I just find it very intriguing to be able to go enter into that market. I visited there this past summer, and I noticed I have so many pictures of waffles over there. It was just a surprise for me to find that out. I went to investigate whether or not, waffles were indeed a part of their menu, and I saw that it was. I saw waffles in grocery stores. I saw they have stores, like cafes, that specifically have waffles. So I think with the growing international community that they have, they're just getting things into their diet and on their menu that wouldn't traditionally be there, maybe. And so there's room for Nicole's Naturals there, and I know that they have a very influential expat community that is interested in gluten-free products. I saw some through the Asian market, particularly China at first, and we're starting with some relationships that we have here in the U.S. that also have relationships there. And so that would be very, very important to me, not to mention I get to use a little bit of my Mandarin that I took right before my trip of going there. So I think that's important too. Today we have to be global citizens, because the world is the U.S. used to brag about being a melting pot, but the melting pot has expanded. And when you go to other countries, you see that there are lots of different nationalities in those countries as well. So that's a good thing, but also within that, you know, it's good to understand different cultures and learn how to speak a little bit of the language. So I find global development, particularly for Nicole's Naturals, very, very intriguing and very possible for us. So that is part of our strategy at this time. Thank you so much for asking, Stephen.
Now, we're going to switch gears a little bit in the interview, in that I want you to sort of think back of all of the successes you've had and the experiences you've been able to have in your past. And if you can describe maybe one or more significant influential achievements, and then what do you see of those achievements today in terms of practical outcomes, and where do you see them going into the future?
That's a good question. I guess I would have to say one of the significant achievements is the computer-aided instruction tutorial that I did back so long ago. And I would call that significant because of, you know, you have Google now. So Google, it's kind of something that you can use to see what is significant. And I see several citations of the work that we did back then. And I think back then, I mean, I am clearly the first that I know of, biomechanics, computer-aided instruction, but of course you have that distinction of biomechanics. But even among that, well, one of the first of computer-aided instructions. And if you know anything about, education now, just having the computer as a part of it is very, very important. And people are really trying to figure out how to engage students, particularly at the higher education level, while using computer instruction. And so I think that's why that project was so significant. I think people are looking back and they're trying to figure out, you know, how was this done in the past and how will this be done, or how should this be done in the future? Now, one of the things that, of course, is important to recognize is that technology has grown, computer technology in particular, but just the amazing invention and streamlining and use of sensors now. I mean, that we're so far beyond where we were all those years ago. People really have to look at the work back then and say, how can we do more and do it differently or do it better, do the same and do it better, have the same impact rather? Because of course, when you're a scientist or engineer and you're doing work or research, you have to evaluate the efficacy and judge the value of what you're doing by how well it works. So we did all that. And so I think that was a significant impact. And one of the other things that I have to say, and probably because it's kind of at the forefront of what I'm doing now, but I think another growing impact, which I hope would be, is what we're doing at Nicole's Naturals. Because one of the things that we do that not a lot of people are doing with gluten-free products is we actually have a proprietary flour that we use, which I think makes our products so successful. And of course, we are debuting with the one waffle and pancake mix, but there are more on the horizon. And I would say, for me, that came from the tinkering. You know, it's back to the watches. You know, you tinker because you have to find a way, you know, growing up, as I did in the South with, bread at every meal, and you're gonna say, hey, now I have this diagnosis where I can no longer eat bread, then immediately I put on my engineering problem solving hat and I have to figure this thing out, you know, I gotta have that bread again. So we figured out how to, make a flour that would allow us to have bread products that had the consistency that people traditionally look for when they ate waffles, pancakes, muffins, things like that. And so I'm hoping that will be significant in the future as we have all of these allergies. I mean, having a food allergy is very, very significant. You know, it's quite different from technology issues, but it's a humanitarian issue. And, you know, food is a basic component. And sometimes in many, many places, you don't get to choose your food. And if you have an allergy, you know, you can't focus on the allergy because you're focusing on, you know, surviving. You have to eat whatever is there. So food allergies are very important, and hopefully one day we'll get to the point where some of these diseases and ailments that people have because they have food allergies will be eradicated because there's inexpensive ways to distribute good food that take these allergies into account. So.
Nicole, just thank you for sharing so much of what you've been doing over the past and how the implications of that work. Again, you have all of this leadership experience. Can you share some of your leadership lessons that can be used by executives in our audience?
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for asking about my leadership experience and just sharing. Of course, as you can tell so far, I'd love to share. I'm so happy to share. And one of the things that I think is so important for leaders of our day and time is to just have a sense of compassion. I think that's important because, you know, you choose what you lead. And picking those projects that you're going to lead, I think it's important to understand them from the perspective of compassion for other people, for the problems that we have in our society today at large, because I would love to have good leaders helping to lead the projects that are significant to the impacts on society. So I think compassion is a great lesson. Also, a sense of teamwork. A leader is not a good leader on their own. Just assembling a great team of people, I talked about that a little bit earlier, people with different skill sets from your own, people with valuable experience in certain key areas depending on the project that you're leading. I think it's so important to have a sense of teamwork, a willingness to build a team and the desire to build a good team and the desire just to not want all the credit yourself, to understand that solutions that are big, bold, and great come from a good team. I think it's very, very important to empower that team of people to not wait on you for direction a lot of times, to come to the table, maybe get your buy-in, of course, on direction, but to come to the table with a sense of direction themselves if they have that. The important thing is just to not stifle energy, to not stifle ideas so that people feel freely to present their ideas, because you never know when that's the idea that's going to lead us to the big solution. I think it's important, very, very important to have a passion for learning as a leader, because well, number one, you usually don't have time to learn. So if you don't have that passion, it's really hard to keep learning. It's hard to keep, you know, seeking out opportunities to learn. But if you have that passion, I find that in times when I'm the busiest, I just, you know, I sit back and I say, hey, I've got to be reading this, or I've got to go to this seminar. You know, I have an intense passion just to keep learning. And I think that's so important for leaders, particularly in this day and time where technology, again, it just is changing at a phenomenal rate. And we, as a leader, you have to at least keep up with a little bit of what's going on, because you never know how you can apply some of those changes, some of those things, some of those experiments, some of those successes of the technology field to your own field, to your problem that you're solving. So it's very important to keep learning, particularly during this day and time. And finally, what I would say, I think one of the biggest things that I would say is needed is patience. Because generally when you're kind of maybe a natural born leader, what some people would say a natural born leader, or someone who has risen to leadership because you're the one that people feel like should be at should be kind of the lead of solving a certain problem, for example. I think you're going to be the type of person that generally wants to get it done and get it done now. At least that's kind of how I am. And so patience is really a virtue at this point, because a lot of problems, especially big problems, can't be solved very fast. And so it's very important that you not only have patience, but I would call it patient persistence. You have to keep digging, keep trying, keep looking. And all this time, continue to be patient and maybe even faithful, just knowing that the solution is out there and that you're going to get to it. But I would say patience is one of the biggest qualities that leaders, particularly of today, should have. And also because today we have problems that you really want to solve right away. I mean, you want solutions to some of these big problems that are very much related to humanity. You want solutions now, but we're not always going to get those solutions now. So patience is very, very important.
Nicole, we're down to our last series of questions, and I know that you've got a really tight schedule, so we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. This first question is about computing. I've been in computing my whole life, and there's this sort of movement to make it into a really recognized profession on par with things like accounting or engineering, your background, where there's demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credentials. What are your views on that?
Wow, that's such an insightful question. I tell you, whether or not we want to make it that officially, it is unofficially. It really is. And I know that throughout this conversation, Stephen, you and I have had technology is something that I've been pushing and just continue to talk about. But the fact of life is computing is a very, very important part of our world right now. We have so many things in the world of computing, the relationship to sensors, the technology of sensors in particular, where we, you know, have them in our phones, and a phone is a very, very important part of our life, you know. So we have things that can monitor our vitals, very, very important things, because, you know, we can stop sicknesses and ailments and things before they happen. And, oh, wow, it just affects so many different aspects of our life. So with that can come a whole host of issues. You mentioned ethics. It's very, very important that we have some ethics around what we do, particularly related to computing, just as we do with engineering, with medicine, with law. Because guess what? Since computing is a part of our lives in so many different ways, we can affect a lot of different dimensions of our life with the use of computers. I mean, people that are probably, I would call, laymen in the world of computing. Maybe you just kind of know of computers from what you do at work and the internet from what you might do in your free time. But you, even those people understand what hacking into different computer systems has done to, sometimes with, in the forms of identity theft. But imagine people taking your medical records and things like that. So there's some ethics there. And when you can control so many parts of society, so many elements of our society, infrastructure, things like that are related to that discipline, it's very, very important that you have some sense of ethics related to that, and you instill that into people who have these skills. It's interesting, you know, but oftentimes people who have the technology skills, the computer, the engineering scientists, they don't get exposed to the humanities in the way that the artists, for example, do. And even the artists or the social scientists don't get exposed to the technology in the way that the engineers and the computer scientists and such do. And we probably need to change that a little bit, because as you can see with Apple and some of the other companies, that's just a big example that most people can relate to. Artistry, humanity, those things are needed in the fields of technology and with the things that computer scientists do to make them more lovely, I like to say, or to make them more user-friendly. And certainly, to kind of wrap up my answer to your question, certainly the humanities, the sense of the arts and things like that are needed for scientists, engineers, for computer scientists, because we're at the point where so many things are possible. But should we, right? We can, but should we? Just because it's possible, should we do it? And sometimes we need an understanding and the compassion that I talked about of the what the humanities gives us in order to answer that question. So I think it's very, very important. And even if it's not being done officially, certainly unofficially, there are organizations out there that are trying to make this happen.
Well, Nicole, you've just been giving some great insights based on your extensive background. Do you have any closing comments before we close the interview?
Well, I have a closing request. If anybody has figured out how to bottle sleep and give it out, I would certainly be an investor in that product. With all the things that I'm passionate about and that I just love to do, every time I visit my doctor, she says, I think you need a little more sleep. And so I'm starting to agree with her, but I just am not sure how to get that and get it all done, as they would say. But Stephen, I really appreciate the opportunity to be among your list of very, very intriguing and interesting interviewees. And thank you so much for having me today for this conversation.
Well, Nicole, thank you. I know your schedule is demanding, and we are indeed fortunate to have you come in to do this interview. And thank you for sharing so much of your experiences and genius with our audience.
You're very welcome. Happy to do it again at any time.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Nicole Washington. Nicole is a renowned serial entrepreneur, innovator, and executive and management consultant.